don't have a lot of money, you're not wealthy, you can't do it. And I said, that means it's going to be hard, but it doesn't mean it's going to be impossible.
A Palmer teacher runs for the Democratic nomination for Lieutenant Governor. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 18th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a Bethel man is recovering after being shot by police on Friday.
It's an ongoing investigation, and we're diligently looking into it right now and as we speak.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com, and by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The primary election is tomorrow, and the Republican candidates for U.S. Senate are scrambling for high-profile endorsements. Meade Treadwell announced today he has astronaut Buzz Aldrin, in addition to Iditarod legend Martin Boozer. Joe Miller boasts Fox TV host Mike Huckabee, and just today focus on the family founder James Dobson. Dan Sullivan landed board members of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Club for Growth, and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Last week, after Miller announced he had Sarah Palin's endorsement, Treadwell countered that he already landed her father-in-law, Jim Palin. Meanwhile, in the House race, Democrat Forrest Dunbar says he has the endorsement of Santa Claus. That is a guy in North Pole who legally changed his name from Tom O'Connor to Santa Claus. Anchorage pollster Mark Helenthal says there's a reason for all this activity. Helenthal says endorsements have an impact on voters, but he warns it's not always positive.
The cost is that the endorsement ad, say, by Palin will go to somebody who doesn't like Palin, and they were voting for you before they got the Palin endorsement, and they say, well, the heck with it. I'm not voting for that person anymore.
Helenthal says the surefire way to win at the endorsement game is to get the blessing of a beloved Alaskan leader, someone who rates very highly with most voters.
That would be Lisa Murkowski, and to my knowledge, he has not endorsed anybody.
In this Republican Senate race, though, a Murkowski endorsement may not be the golden ticket. Joe Miller is accusing anyone associating with her of being insufficiently conservative. On top of the Republican Senate primary and the oil tax referendum, there's one more competitive statewide race on tomorrow's ballot, the contest for the Democrats' lieutenant governor nominee. In the wake of what Governor Sean Parnell dubbed the education session, half a dozen of the new candidates being fielded by the Democratic Party are educators. The most high profile of these is Bob Williams, who was once named the Alaska Teacher of the Year and is now a candidate for lieutenant governor. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has this profile.
Bob Williams teaches math at Palmer's Colony High School, not government. But over the past year, he's gotten a pretty serious crash course in civics.
Going through this process of running for lieutenant governor is, I thought like maybe you could watch a debate and before and kind of say, oh, maybe I'd do this. I thought you could maybe vicariously go through things. And what one of the things I've learned is, you really can't learn any better than by doing.
Williams is a first-time candidate, and he's running against State Senator Hollis French for the Democratic nomination. Before running for lieutenant governor, the closest Williams had ever gotten to elected politics was participating in Boys State, a mock legislature conference for high schoolers. He presents himself as a Mr. Smith goes to Juno type of figure and speaks with the same level of enthusiasm he might use to get kids excited about algebra. Because he's starting big and running for a statewide seat, Williams says he's encountered some skepticism toward his campaign.
You don't have a lot of money, you're not wealthy, you can't do it. And I said, that means it's going to be hard, but it doesn't mean it's going to be impossible. And so you talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people said, well, you're just a teacher. And I'd say, well, what do you expect, you know, what are you looking for in your next lieutenant governor? You know, teachers deal with conflict in a civil way, they build trust, they have integrity.
On the issues, Williams, like French, mostly seems to line up with the Democratic Party platform. But as a teacher, he says education issues really helped motivate him to file for office. When Williams declared his candidacy last year, it was shortly after a legislative session where lawmakers considered allowing public dollars to go to private schools.
The reform efforts that were being pushed forward in the last couple of years haven't made sense. And so that's one of the things where you push and say, hey, we need something different. We need different people.
Williams is far from the only teacher running this cycle. Democrats are fielding 5 new legislative candidates who are active or retired teachers, and 4 of those are running in the Republican stronghold of MATSU. In Ketchikan, teacher Dan Ortiz is running as an independent candidate. Williams says the crew of teacher candidates will sometimes chat about their campaigns with the purpose of
giving advice and a lot of moral support and some policy on education.
Zach Fields is a spokesperson for the Alaska Democratic Party, and he says a heated fight over education funding, where a grassroots coalition of parents fought for an increase in classroom dollars,
definitely catalyzed a lot of public anger, and it has resulted in an unusually large number of teachers and also students and parents being involved in this election cycle.
In the state legislature, fewer than a handful of office holders have teaching experience, and most of those lawmakers are Republicans. If Williams were to pull off 2 upsets, one on Tuesday against Hollis French, and another in November as part of a gubernatorial ticket with Byron Mallott against incumbent Governor Sean Parnell, the office of lieutenant governor wouldn't afford him too much opportunity to get hands-on with education policy. The office has few powers, but it would elevate his public profile. He says he'd approach his job like his current one.
I've been building trust in the classroom and in the community for 20 years. My classroom just got a lot bigger. I'll be doing that across the state of Alaska.
And if elected politics don't pan out, at least the experience will have been an educational one. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz is in Alaska this week. He says the Obama administration wants to spur a project to export North Slope natural gas. And Moniz says the number one way his department can help is by staying out of the way.
Understanding that ultimately these are going to be some major private sector economic decisions to be made, but we are determined not to be an obstacle in any way in that pathway. Getting Alaskan gas monetized is good for the Alaska, good for the country, and good for our international security obligations.
Alaska's oil producers applied to the Department of Energy last month for permits to export liquefied natural gas. The project will require an 800-mile pipeline, a liquefaction plant at Nikiski, and other infrastructure. The companies haven't committed to building the $50 billion system. Proposals to export gas from the lower 48 are controversial because of concerns they will boost the domestic price of fuel. Moniz says the administration has already decided the Alaska project will be exempt from requirements to show the price impact on domestic markets. Moniz is one of 4 Obama cabinet members visiting Alaska this summer. The secretaries of Labor, Transportation, and Commerce attended campaign fundraisers for Senator Mark Begich. Moniz says he isn't attending any fundraising events on this trip. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a symbolic measure to protect mushing in Alaska.
But I think it also speaks that every legislator in the state has agreed that mushing is worth preserving.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
A 31-year-old Bethel man is recovering after being shot by a police officer during an altercation on Friday. The man, Aaron Moses, was stabilized in Bethel and medevaced to Anchorage. One officer was also treated for minor injuries. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
interim city manager Greg Moyer could not share any additional details Friday evening.
It's an ongoing investigation, and we're diligently looking into it right now and as we speak.
According to the Alaska State Troopers, officers with the Bethel Police Department responded to a disturbance at about 10:35 Friday morning. Upon arrival, they came into contact with a man holding a baseball bat. Officers engaged in efforts to control the man, including the use of a taser, according to Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters.
It resulted in a struggle in which one of the officers was struck by the baseball bat. One of the officers was able to draw a firearm.
A video of the incident provided to KYUK indicates a shot fired while one officer was set back, another officer was on the ground, and Moses was standing close with the baseball bat raised. Troopers say he was shot in the abdomen. Greg Moyer says the two officers were placed on administrative leave as per policy. A witness, Ryan White, says he saw Moses walking outside Friday morning with a baseball bat. He says Moses ran toward the police with a bat at one point, then stepped back for a moment.
I'm not really sure if he was trying to run past them or not, and they tried tasing him twice. Both cops used their tasers on him.
After that, White says one of the officers shot the man. They then ran to handcuff him. State troopers are investigating after they were contacted by the police department. Members of the Alaska Bureau of Investigation arrived Friday to secure the scene and investigate. Bethel police have not commented on the incident. When reached by KYUK, state troopers declined to share any more information. A family member confirms that Moses is stable and is being treated in the intensive care unit at the Alaska Native Medical Center on Monday. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Alaska State Troopers are investigating vandalism at the Delta Junction Cemetery over the weekend. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the vandals drove through the fence both on the way in and out of the cemetery and then ran over several grave sites on their way to a gazebo, which they nearly destroyed.
Delta City officials say the damage at Rest Haven Cemetery was reported around 9 a.m. Sunday by a city worker who'd gone there to help with a burial scheduled for later in the morning. As he surveyed the damage, City Administrator Mike Twangy struggled to find words to describe the shock and outrage that he and many other area residents were feeling as word of the vandalism spread. Twangy says city staff will contact family members of those whose graves were damaged during the vandals' destructive joyride.
Certainly we would call families and alert them to what happened. It's absolute disrespect of those here and families of those loved ones. So it's sad. It's to me, it's just sad.
But it appears the grave sites weren't the main goal of the vandals. They just happened to be in the path that they took to get to the gazebo in the center of the cemetery. That's how it looked to Twangy as he walked along the tire tracks that run from where the vehicle apparently smashed through the fence to get in and a few feet away where it smashed its way out.
Damage to the fence in two different places so far.
The support posts on all four corners of the structure were broken, causing the roof to collapse onto the deck. Twangy says it appears the vandals may have lashed a strap onto one or more of the posts to facilitate the destruction.
Well, they hooked a strap up to it, it looks like, and tore the building down.
The gazebo was built in 2008 by a Delta youth for his Eagle Scout project. A plaque on the structure states that Scout Matt Jocelyn dedicated it to his baby brother, who died soon after birth. Twangy and Delta Mayor Pro Tem Mary Leith, who was also there to check the damage, both say it's hard to assign a cost estimate to repair the gazebo because it, like the rest of the cemetery, was built with volunteer labor and donated or discounted materials, which, in a way, makes the vandalism all the more aggravating.
This has all been done with volunteer labor, and then these idiots come along. I just don't I don't get the mindset. It's just a bunch of people putting their heart into the place, and then some idiot comes along.
Troopers weren't saying much about the incident Sunday. Spokeswoman Megan Peters would only confirm that an investigation is underway. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Homeless youth in Juneau don't have a lot of options when it comes to housing, especially if they're on their own. Many of them couch surf or go camping when the weather's nice, but there's another option many may not be aware of, Juneau Youth Services Transitional Living Program. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Alyssa White says she hit rock bottom before moving into a JYS transitional living apartment. The 21-year-old had been living in the dorms at the University of Alaska Southeast.
I was a partier, a pretty bad partier.
She says JYS gave her a place to live, set her up with substance abuse counseling, and generally helped turn her life around. If she hadn't gotten into the transitional living program, White says she probably would have ended up on the streets selling stuff to feed her drug habit. Today, she works two jobs and lives with her mom. She says they have a good relationship after a rough patch in her teens.
I owe a lot to those people. Like, they really changed my whole perspective and helped me, like, maintain my jobs and helped me, you know, realize that I'm a worthwhile person.
The Black Bear Apartments are nestled into a stand of trees in the Mendenhall Valley. Transitional Living Supervisor Henry Wyatt says it's one of two complexes where clients live during the program.
This is one of our two bedrooms.
Compared to transitional living facilities in other parts of the country, Wyatt says these apartments feel less institutional. They range from efficiencies to a four-bedroom unit. He says the girls' apartments tend to be decorated like home, while the boys' are more like college dorms.
We had one client a while back. He's a gamer, super into video games. He covered his wall in video game posters, and he took all the discs out of their boxes and had them all hanging on the wall.
JYS has 9 apartments and can serve up to 18 clients ages 16 to 21.
Some of them are coming from homes where there's a lot of drug abuse, maybe physical, emotional abuse. Some kids are just living on the street. They've literally been kicked out of their house and are either couch surfing or sleeping in the woods.
Besides housing, the transitional living program offers life skills classes, which Wyatt admits doesn't sound very exciting.
It sounds like something a 50-year-old said, these kids need life skills.
But he says it's better than the alternative of figuring it out on your own.
A lot of people learn how to manage their credit by totally destroying their credit in their early 20s and go, oh yeah, okay, that's what I shouldn't do. A lot of people learn how to budget by not budgeting well for 10 years and then going, oh, okay, well, I should probably budget my money. That makes more sense.
JYS does have ground rules. For example, clients are expected to have a job or be in school. If they can't find a job, they can do community service while they look for one. They pay 30% of their income as rent, an amount based on the federal definition of affordable housing. They get 30% of that back when they leave the program. Clients are only allowed to stay in transitional housing for a year and a half, and they age out once they turn 22. Drugs and alcohol are not allowed. JYS offers its own substance abuse counseling, or it can set up clients with third-party services. Counselor Lindsay Bray says some issues are too serious for kids to be in the program.
If they do come in and they have some issues with chemical dependency or they've got a chronic mental health concern, then we expect that they're either already actively managing that situation or we try to connect them with resources to make that happen.
Alyssa White says for her, stability was the most beneficial part of the transitional living program.
I never really had that one person or a group of people to be like, hey, we're here for you.
White says she's still in touch with the JYS staff and knows they'll be there for her no matter what issues come up in her life. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA.
Brown bear hunting in the Kenai Wildlife Refuge could be closed entirely this year. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, the refuge's proposal comes just days after a call for a full and permanent ban on brown bear hunting.
The Center for Biological Diversity issued the call for the full ban, and the refuge responded with a scaled-back plan. Kirsten Lippman is a conservation biologist for the center. She says the one-year ban offered up by the refuge is a good step.
Well, we were really happy to see that, no question about it, especially because the hunt is scheduled to start September 1st
So we were really concerned about what would happen once that opened up. So it's great to see the refuge kind of taking the steps they need to protect the bears on their lands from the overhunting that's occurring.
Last spring, the State Board of Game voted to expand harvest opportunities for brown bears, in part based on public testimony. People have said for some time and continue to say there are simply too many bears on the Kenai and that interactions are becoming more frequent. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which oversees the refuge, there are about 600 brown bears on the Kenai Peninsula, and that population is genetically unique and almost completely isolated. And so the struggle between state and federal management agencies is in finding the lowest number of bears necessary to sustain the population. Last fall, a meeting was held in Soldotna where, again, the call was made to allow a higher take of bears to curb conflicts. Doug Vincent Lang, director of the State Division of Wildlife Conservation, said getting agreement on what that lowest number is has been difficult.
In many discussions with the service, we have been told that their legal mandates require them to and the state to maintain, quote, natural diversity on the refuge. State regulations must maintain the important biological functions that brown bears serve and have served as predators and recyclers of marine-derived nutrients. Unfortunately, none of these provide specific metrics to guide state management and prevent preemption, so we are left to guess and interpret to the best of our ability what these undefined goals might mean.
The board set up a 3-year trial program for the expanded hunt. They would allow baiting stations to be set up, and they also put a cap in place. 70 bears would be the maximum number that could be harvested. According to the Wildlife Refuge, 71 bear mortalities were documented in 2013, and 54 more have been counted so far this year. Kirsten Lippmann says there could have been some middle ground when the board made its decision. She says 70 bears a year is just too many, and some of the means, like the baiting stations, aren't the best methods to help control populations.
So that's certainly one aspect of it that could have been met at a happy medium, either by eliminating, you know, not allowing brown bear baiting at all, like the refuge has already banned brown bear baiting on its lands anyway, or just limiting the number of bears killed at bait stations to a more reasonable number, a more sustainable number.
But finding what that sustainable number is has been tricky. Not only is there disagreement between agencies and residents about the overall population, but also about just exactly how many bears are necessary to maintain it. Bill Iverson spoke at that same meeting in the fall on behalf of the Alaska Outdoor Council. He highlighted another problem in managing the issue, the different goals of the state and federal agencies that are in charge.
We're trying to reduce the number of bears and bear conflicts that we're having in the area, and they want to increase the number of bears, and that's the last thing we need is more bears down here. I lived at the Funny River Road. I've had more bear conflicts in the last 10 years than I care to think about, but in the last 2 or 3 years, those numbers have plummeted.
And he gives credit for that drop in his number of conflicts to the increased harvest opportunities. But if reducing the amount of bear-human conflicts is the goal, Lippmann says education needs to be a part of the strategy too, and simply liberalizing hunting opportunities doesn't necessarily help meet that goal. It's not just the number of bears, but which individuals in the population you target that can make a difference.
You might be taking out those bears that have lived in that area for years. They're habituated to people. They avoid contact with humans. You know, they're old, wise, wily bears that have managed to coexist at that interface for quite some time. So you're killing off bears that really haven't been a problem and opening up the door for young bears, you know, especially young adolescent male bears that generally cause the problems to come in there. You're actually potentially making it worse.
The refuge is taking public comments on its proposal to nix the bear hunt between September 1st and May 31st of next year until August 27th. There are also two public meetings planned, one at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office in Anchorage on August 26th, and another the following evening at the Soldotna Sports Complex. Both of those meetings are scheduled for 6 p.m. In Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Sled dog racing is Alaska's state sport, and last week, Governor Sean Parnell signed a resolution, quote, recognizing, honoring, and encouraging support for dog mushing in Alaska. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur has more.
Nome residents Deanna Hacker and Niels Hahn drafted House Concurrent Resolution 24 to safeguard the sport and its human and canine participants throughout the state. Here's Hacker.
It has its place in history, its place in the present, and I think most certainly its place in the future. and we felt it needed to be preserved.
Hacker and Hahn run their own kennel and modeled the resolution off the nation's right to farm statutes, which protect farmers and ranchers from nuisance lawsuits complaining of farming-related activities like noise or smell. Alaska's right to mush resolution is not statutory, but rather signifies the legislator's support of mushing and its significance to the culture and people of Alaska.
It's more a symbolic resolution, but I think it also speaks that every legislator in the state has agreed that mushing is worth preserving and that it is an acceptable activity in the state.
The pair created the resolution after mushers across the state began reporting harassment, like obstructed trails, traps set on trails, and lawsuits threatening kennel operations. The resolution received statewide support from the Alaska Federation of Natives, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and the Willow Area Community Organization. 4-time Iditarod champion Lance Mackey and 15-time Iditarod finisher Mike Williams Sr. rallied behind its passage. And Nome Kennel Club President Christy Selesky signed a resolution of support.
It gives backing to us, reassuring us from the state that this is something that they want to see continue and not cease to exist.
Selesky points out many mushers engage in the sport recreationally rather than competitively, though some still use teams to run trap lines and haul wood. Selesky says the resolution goes beyond protecting a sport to sustaining a lifestyle.
Even though we have all these races going on and stuff, there's a lot of people in smaller communities, Nome too, where we're just recreational mushers, but it's still our way of life, and it's just great to have something in effect from the state that supports our way of life so mushing can still continue to thrive into the future.
Representative Neil Foster carried the resolution through the House and addressed the legislature in a floor speech.
It's good for the state because it's an image of the state. When people think of Alaska, they also think of dog mushing. And it's great for the economy because so many people come from other states to Alaska to see the various races. We see this as a positive thing, you know, and we just want to let folks know that we support them.
Both the House and Senate unanimously passed the resolution in March as Iditarod finishers were crossing beneath the burled arch in Nome. In Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had help tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Delta, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez and Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, where more than 1,000 Alaskan men and women are working on the Point Thompson Project, proving energy lives here. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. Public Employees Local 71 asks you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska. Alaska laborers and the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities also know the importance of safe driving in construction zones. This message sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.